This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Europe has been under attack from radical Islamists who are trying to start a holy war, a replay of the Crusades between Islam and Catholicism. Could Europe actually step away from its secularist tendencies and take on a more Catholic identity? History gives some really interesting answers to that question. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about some of this, including the history of Napoleon that anyone interested in Europe's future will really find fascinating. Since the nuclear deal was implemented in January, Iran has been strengthening its relationships with nations around the world, including those in Latin America. Last month, Iran's foreign minister took a huge delegation to Cuba, Chile, Venezuela, other countries in the region, and it raises the question, shouldn't the U.S. be concerned? Iran is still the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism. What about Europe, which has a long history of ties with Latin America? We're going to talk with trumpet writer Anthony Chibatadwe to get answers to these questions. What is the biggest ingredient for success in life? Is it intelligence? Is it talent or luck? Well, recent studies say no, it's actually something called grit. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about what is grit and how can we get it. And I'll conclude the program by talking about an important ingredient that really makes a family a family. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. In our world today, we have a strong, violent group of people who are waging religious war. As much as people want to keep religion out of it, you can't deny the fact that radical Muslims are committing acts of terrorism and violence in the name of their religion. Throughout Africa and in some Middle Eastern countries, some of these attacks are specifically being directed against Christians. And some of the radicals are saying that they want to attack Rome, the center of Catholicism. They're actively, vocally campaigning for another religious crusade. They're referencing these violent wars between Muslims and Catholics in centuries past. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer takes up an interesting question in an article that he's working on. What are the chances that Europe would respond in kind, religious-wise? We think of Europe as deeply secular, not really ones to use to fight for their religious beliefs, certainly. And yet, to anyone who has seen much from the trumpet, we talk quite a lot about how we expect religion to be a major unifying force in a coming European empire. What would it take for Europe to adopt a strong Christian Catholic identity? To talk about this, we have Richard via Skype from our office in Britain. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's start by just talking about the religious climate in Europe today. We know that it's quite secular in the modern age, but is there any indication that the threats that we see increasing in the world today are affecting that adherence to secularist ideals?
Yes, I think so. I think the most public is the discussion over the burkini ban in France. I mean, that's being upheld in the name of secularism, but you see the kind of the most immediate response to a series of terrorist attacks in France on Muslims hasn't been something that would actually make France safer. I don't think anybody is saying that banning this swimming costume in southern France is going to affect actual terrorist attacks. But the instinctive reaction for Europe is to lash out, or for France, is to lash out against a symbol of cultural identity, something strongly associated with Islam. So I think it is interesting that you see this immediate, almost knee-jerk response is something that focuses on the intangible belief system of the attackers rather than something tangible, like a way of maneuvering a weapon or something, or concealing a weapon or something like that.
It's one thing, I guess, to hear Europeans saying, well, we don't want this particular symbol attached to Islamism in our midst. But is there anything to suggest that, say, Europe would come to embrace something more robustly Catholic and in terms of cultural and religious identity?
Well, Christianity is still probably the biggest thing that Europe has in common as a whole, in terms of an identity that spans borders. So over 75% of Europeans consider themselves Christian. So that's the vast majority. And 48% of Christians in Europe consider themselves Catholic. So you have a very strong, still a very strong background and in Christianity. Now, public displays of religion are definitely out of fashion, and that's something that has gone down. And that's there. I think there are some quite deep roots in terms of it going back to the Enlightenment in several countries that behind that. And then also, people I think are less inclined to listen to the Catholic Church when it comes to morality. And I think that is a fairly big reason why people have written off the role of the Catholic Church. You know, when people are deciding, is abortion right or wrong? Is homosexuality or homosexual behavior right or wrong? Is contraception use right or wrong? A lot of people are deciding for themselves rather than taking on Catholic doctrine and dogma. However, though, we're talking more here about Christian identity, the possibility of the Catholic Church as a unifier. And when you look at it in those terms, Europe is still very Catholic, even if they're not necessarily giving the Catholic Church the same say over their lives that they have in the past.
So these Muslims who are evoking crusade-era violence and warfare, they're looking back quite a number of years in history. But when you look at even more recent European history, you bring some of this up in just the material that you've been working on for this article so far, that would suggest that there is actually a good likelihood that religion could be used for more specific political purposes within Europe as a unifying force, to show how this might be a model that could be resurrected very soon.
Right. And so in this article, I've been going back over some of the history of the French Revolution and Napoleon. And I think one of the fascinating things about this, when it comes to, say, some of the other times that Catholicism was dominant within Europe, say, you know, Charlemagne, we don't have as much material from written by the people right at the very top expressing their beliefs, talking about why they're using the Catholic Church, what they hope to gain. But for Napoleon, we do. We have a wealth of that. We have a lot of his letters. This is something that's very recent, so we have a lot of material about it. And there's a lot of very interesting parallels, I think, between today. I mean, if you look at what France was before Napoleon took charge, it makes Europe today look religious by comparison. The French Revolution was very anti-Catholic and made a concerted effort to just stamp out Catholicism and anything to do with Catholicism everywhere they can find it. So, for example, just the calendar, that is heavily influenced by the Catholic Church. And so the French Revolution got rid of it. They came up with their own calendar, their own names for months, you know, the Catholic holy days, festivals, all gone. And then this went down even to the week, and not just to changing French week names or changing the day of rest, but they even got rid of the 7-day week. And because so much of the Enlightenment of the French Revolution was meant to kind of stem from the Enlightenment and be more rational, they decided a 10-day week would be more rational than a 7. So they got rid of the 7-day week. They had a 10-day week with a day of rest every 10 days. So everything they could to completely purge Catholicism from society. Now, they still were. They couldn't erase Catholicism from everybody's minds. There were still those who wanted to stick to that belief. They came up with things like the cult of reason, the cult of the supreme being, to kind of have their own rationalist religion. But then they also imposed a lot of limits on the Catholic Church, and clergy that refused to swear allegiance to the revolution and this revolutionary regime were put to death. And there was the death warrant out for a lot of clergy. So
This is very hostile in a way that you really don't see even close to anything like that in Europe today. And yet, Napoleon came on the scene and he actually used Catholicism and kind of resurrected it for his own purposes.
Right, exactly. And Napoleon wasn't somebody who was, say, predisposed to be friendly to the Catholic Church. Even from his youth in Corsica, there was opposition. He was opposed to a lot of the Catholic Church and disliked its priests and things. But he saw the value that this had, and he before he became first consul, before he took over France, while he was still a general for that revolutionary regime, he really rose to power fighting in Italy. And one of his chief oppositions was the Catholic Church, and he saw its ability to inspire, to give an identity firsthand. At that time, Italy wasn't a single nation. It was divided up into these different city-states and these different regions. But it was the Catholic Church that helped provide a sense of unity, a sense of purpose to the anti-French rebellion. And it was the Catholic Church that would keep stirring up opposition to Napoleon and his armies. And because of his government and the positions of his government, he was really forced into opposition to the Catholic Church, even fighting directly with its armies. And he put out the death penalty for priests that led rebel bands. He destroyed church bells that were being used to raise guerrilla forces against him. So he was fighting the Catholic Church. But in doing that fighting, he got a firsthand glimpse of the power that he had. Andrew Roberts, recently, he wrote a biography of Napoleon called Napoleon the Great. And he wrote that Italy instilled in him a respect for the power of the church as an institution, which he realized he could not wholly oppose. And he wrote back at the time, it was a great mistake to quarrel with that power, with the church. And so this campaign in Italy really helped form his views as to the necessity of the Catholic Church as an identity and as a unifying power to these nations with this Christian heritage.
So this was something that Napoleon used then once he came to power. Tell us about that.
Right. So after Italy, he went to the Middle East, and there he tried to use Islam to similar effect. Then he came back to France. He took over. He became first consul, ruler of France. And this was one of the first things that he tried to do, was come to an agreement with the Catholic Church. He began negotiations right in the first year of his consulship. And against great opposition from a lot of people at the very top, from the revolutionary regime, from the army, he came and concluded this concordat with the Catholic Church. And this got rid of things like the 10-day week. It eventually got rid of this calendar that got rid of the Catholic Church. It acknowledged the church's position, the church as being the religion of the great majority of French citizens. It reestablished Catholic worship. So the Catholic Church was restored, not to exactly the same position it had before the revolution, but still to be of great power in France. And it was given back control over education in elementary schools, for example. But then Napoleon also got something in return. He got recognition internationally, which was very important to him, and it helped with his campaign to gain power within Europe. And then it helped him nationally as well. The priests had to swear not to disturb the public tranquility. They preached in their churches the necessity of conscription and of supporting France's armies. But the fact that he did this right away, and it took a few years to do all the negotiations, but he got started almost right away. And that shows the emphasis and importance that he put on coming to an agreement and having the help of the Catholic Church.
Richard has helped a great deal with a book that we make available for free by trumpet writer Brad McDonald. It's called The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. Napoleon, his history is in there to some degree, or getting into some details that I think really amplify the message in that book. But when you look at least in the modern era, how much religion has played a role in those times when Europe did come together as a unified force, it's almost inconceivable that Europe would be able to unify without that religious influence. Napoleon recognized it. There were several other leaders in European history who have recognized that. And considering the scope of the threats that Europe is facing today and the religious nature of at least the, say, one of the most aggressive of those threats, it is interesting to look at this as really setting us up for another iteration of that same historical pattern that we've seen play out so many times.
Right. There really is a Catholic Church-shaped hole in the heart of Europe in a lot of ways, because they are, on the one hand, they have this radical Islam trying to force a religious conflict. But at the same time, you have Europe that's kind of lost its way a bit. You know, after Brexit, there's a lot of people asking, well, what is the European Union for? What is it that really holds us all together? What loyalty do I owe Europe? And the Catholic Church is at the heart of that common heritage. And Samuel Huntington, in his book Clash of Civilizations, just talked about how in this modern world, people are being forced together in these larger civilizational blocks. You know, nations just on a much smaller level would just be crushed in the clash if they didn't band together. And they need these things to join them together. And what is the only thing? And so the Europe is being forced together as by a lot of these forces, by Russia and its expansionism, by radical Islam. Well, what is it that unites Europe? Well, really the only thing there is its Christian heritage. And you know, you mentioned the history and this book that we've been putting together, or that we put together, on the Holy Roman Empire. And you do see throughout that history, European leaders using the Catholic Church to achieve unity. You also see throughout that history a certain amount of conflict with the Catholic Church, because the national leaders want power for themselves. They don't want to have to share it with the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church doesn't want to have to share it with those national leaders. And it led to Napoleon eventually falling out with the Catholic Church. That's something that happened several times. So I don't think it's something that European leaders are particularly willing to do. But more and more, they're getting forced in that direction. It's becoming unavoidable if they want to keep their European project from falling apart. And so now that we see Europe under more pressure than ever before, that it's closer than ever before now from being forced to reach for the Catholic Church and to really bring them in a way that they were right at the start of the European project, but haven't been since.
Looking at really what informs so much of what we talk about with respect to religion in Europe, these biblical prophecies that describe this political / military power that is unified by, unified with, and even driven by a religious power, this church-state combine, you would almost expect that there would be, it would be a very natural kind of a union. But you look at some of the details of that history and some of the former iterations of that church-state union, and you really do see a lot of push and pull, a lot of contention, a lot of ugliness, and the way that it comes together, there's a lot of opportunism that really reflects just the messy nature of this entity. And so it's easier to see how that might play out given the political and religious climate in Europe today.
Right. And that's why I think Napoleon is just such a great example for today, because we do have so many of those details, so many of the letters and record of negotiation with the Catholic Church. And you just really see how it is the natural consequence of different groups trying to gain power. And so Napoleon wants power, he goes to the church. The Catholic Church also wants power, and it works very well for them to have a strong military power working alongside. But then you see it with Napoleon. You saw it most famously with the investiture controversy and the Holy Roman Empire, where once they have that power, both want to be the only power at that point, and things start to fall apart again.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about religion and specifically Catholicism in Europe. He's writing an article about this for the coming Trumpet print edition. And you can watch for that. It'll be a little while before that appears online, but it will appear on thetrumpet.com. But it's a fascinating subject, Richard, and I think so much of the history that you're bringing up it does just add a level of interest and complexity to this subject that I think is really worthwhile looking into. We appreciate you sharing that with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Since the nuclear deal was implemented at the beginning of this year, Iran has strengthened its relations with many other countries around the world. And one area it is formalizing ties with is Latin America. Last month, Iran's foreign minister took his first ever official visit to the region. He took a huge delegation to Cuba, Nicaragua, Chile, Venezuela, and other countries. How concerned should America be about the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism making inroads right on its back doorstep? We have to discuss this Trumpet writer Anthony Chibodadwe. Hello.
Hello.
So how deep, first of all, are Iran's current ties with Latin American countries? How strong are the relationships here?
Good question. Iran has been, especially with the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran, Iran has been trying all it can to try to reach out to as many friends as it could. And in Latin America, it has found those friends, and it has been using those relations with those nations to try to circumvent the sanctions against Iran. And now that a lot of those sanctions have been removed, Iran now finds it even a lot easier. It finds it a lot easier to cement those ties. In fact, Zarif, when he was in Cuba, he said that...
This is the foreign minister, Iran's foreign minister.
Yes. Javad Zarif, when he went to Cuba, he said that the Iran nuclear deal has removed obstacles between Iran and Latin America. So now it's working hard to cement those ties.
So these Latin American countries, how eager are they to forge these kinds of ties with Iran?
Another good question. Let's just look at Cuba, for example. Cuba, if you remember, it was one of the state sponsors of terrorism, just like Iran. But the Obama administration has been befriending Cuba, and it has removed Cuba from that list. And President Obama even visited Cuba recently, but as people would remember, he was snubbed by the Cuban president. He didn't even pay a visit. He didn't meet him at the airport. But when the Iranian foreign minister went to Cuba, he got even better reception than that. I think that's very symbolic, and it just shows how much Cuba is willing to reach out to Iran and forge deals with Iran. And it's not just Cuba, all these nations that this foreign minister visited, they embraced Iran. They signed a lot of business deals with a lot of these nations. Some of these nations, they've been struggling economically, so they welcome this. They welcome this.
Now, what's happened, say, since January when the nuclear deal was implemented, this is probably more out in the open. I mean, when you have a delegation of 120 Iranian officials touring around Latin America, that's a pretty splashy statement to make. But these ties actually have longer history than just in the last 9 months. You and I had even talked on a previous program about inroads that Iran had made into Argentina some years ago, an anti-Semitic attack that Iran sponsored. Maybe you could just put these current relationships in more of a historical context for us.
A lot of analysts who have looked at these countries that the foreign minister visited, they find one common denominator that ties all these nations together, and that denominator is Hezbollah, Iran's terrorist proxy. This terrorist group has been expanding in Latin America, even up to Mexico. There have been lots of reports about Hezbollah collaborating with drug cartels, and even possibly infiltrating the U.S. border. So the one common factor has been Hezbollah in all these nations. Hezbollah has found a safe haven, and they have been expanding and converting a lot of people to Islam, specifically the brand of Islam that Iran espouses, with just the Shiite religion. And Iran has been taking advantage of how anti-Western some of these nations have been, and it has found it a lot easier to develop and expand more. The one thing that's, I guess I would say, interesting about Iran and the way it has infiltrated Latin America is how it has used its embassies and its economic ventures in these countries as a cover for its expansion, like it's expanding its religion, its revolution, and even expand Hezbollah in the region. So I think that's probably the one main significant thing about this visit. We don't know everything that Zarif discussed with these nations, but we do know that in the past, Iran has used diplomacy as a cover for expansion in Iran. And a good example is Argentina with that attack that we mentioned. It happened way back in 1994. And even though that terrorist bombing in 1994 has not fully been resolved, a lot of investigations over the years have revealed Iran's hand in it and how it used its embassies. In Latin America, specifically in Argentina, Iran used this individual. His name is Mohsen Rabbani, and he is an Iranian intelligence agent who worked under many different covers. He pretended he was just a Shiite cleric. He pretended he was a cultural attaché. He pretended he was a meat inspector. And he was all these things in addition to the lead person that Iran used to expand its terror network. In fact, he was indicted as being responsible for that attack in Argentina. And that individual, by the way, he is back in Iran because his name has been coming up. He's on Interpol's red notice, but he was moved back to Iran. But he still has been traveling to Brazil. There's been evidence of him still traveling to Brazil under different passports. So Iran still has that influence in Latin America, and it seems like not much is being done about it.
Well, it certainly seems concerning from the United States standpoint to have Iranian sponsorship of Hezbollah right on its southern border. But you make some interesting points in this article that you're working on that really puts it in context of a larger war, or say a building toward war, that we see happening within the Middle East. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory has drawn a lot of attention to this pending conflict between Iran and Germany, or a European empire. And you have to think that Europe is watching what's going on down in Latin America and really would have to be pretty alarmed to see Iran making inroads into an area that it feels that it has a certain amount of legitimate claim to.
Yes, these nations that we're talking about, Cuba, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Chile, Bolivia, Venezuela, that's not a very impressive list of nations. These are nations that have a lot of that are led by dictators. They are very anti-Western. They are predominantly socialist. And just to give you an example, in Brazil, just like with a few other nations in Latin America recently, they have had a lot of changes in their leadership. Their leadership has moved more towards the West. It has been more pro-Western. If you look at Argentina, the Kirchner regime has been replaced by a regime that's more pro-Europe, pro-American. Same thing in Brazil recently with the oust of Dilma Rousseff. Now you have a new government that's more pro-American, pro-European. Some of the nations that actually reacted against the new developments in Brazil specifically have been Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador. They actually recalled their ambassadors to Brazil because Brazil had just installed a new government that's pro-Western. So you have these nations that are anti-Western, that are building this relationship with Iran. So that's a big cause of concern, especially amidst this sea of change, in the sea of change in Latin America, where you're seeing this shift nation by nation. Look at Venezuela, for example. There are protests almost every day in Venezuela. And
the protests against the Venezuelan government, yes, just because of bad social conditions in that country.
Bad social conditions started off with Hugo Chavez, now with Nicolas Maduro.
They're kind of reaping the bitter fruits of some of those failed socialist policies down there. And the people are really ripe for something new.
They're ripe for something new. The people, but the government still has these ties with nations like Iran. And you can imagine that there'll be a lot more people who want to empower those the ordinary Venezuelan to force for new elections. That's what they're trying to aim for. They want a new regime. So you have Latin America is in the midst of a lot of change, political change, and it's just a tide that we have been seeing, and it seems like Iran has been trying to stop it, considering some of these nations that it's trying to build ties with. So it's interesting just to see how much enemies Iran is creating by cementing these ties.
Well, it will be interesting, and we've drawn a lot of attention in the past to just how much Catholic influence there is in Latin America and how strong the ties are between Latin America and Catholic Europe, and how we would expect there to be a resurrection of some of those ties in the time ahead, and yet to have an Iranian influence and infiltration in that area, it seems like it would provoke some kind of reaction from Europeans who are trying to shore up those ties themselves. It seems very likely in the time ahead that Latin America could prove to be some kind of a proxy battleground for other nations. You also have Asian influence, Chinese influence in there, and seeing exactly how all of this plays out among these nations that have this political instability taking place at the same time. It will be interesting to keep our eyes on. We've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chibatadwe. He's working on an article about the threat of Iranian terror in Latin America. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Anthony. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Success can come as a result of many different factors, intelligence, talent, sheer luck. But according to a number of recent studies, all of these factors are trumped by sheer grit. And to talk about this, we have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
So define grit for us. What are we talking about here?
Well, I would define it as passion and perseverance for especially long-term goals. And really that definition is lifted from this new book called Grit. Actually, the subtitle is The Power of Passion and Perseverance. It's by Angela Duckworth. And I think she just makes a really compelling case that proves essentially that for success, grit is more important than intelligence or talent or luck or those other factors that you mentioned.
So a lot of people, they look at the elite in any given field. You look at the Olympic athletes, or you look at the those who are at the highest of their field in engineering or whatever the case might be, and kind of think that they have this special composition within them. They've got the talent, they've got the body type or whatever it is that enables them to really excel. But how much could the average person get there just from the application of effort and grit, like you're describing, this passion and perseverance toward whatever goal that they would shoot for?
Well, according to a growing body of research, it really looks like each individual is much more in control of achieving even elite level success than was long thought. You know, we often look at those athletes and those experts in whatever field it may be and say, wow, it's a gift. That person is just blessed with incredible natural ability. And we just kind of throw up our hands and say, wow, that would be nice to be like that. But really, if you try to cultivate grit, and if you really break it down into its individual components and work to expand those in your life, then you can be an incredible success in a lot of areas. It's genetics definitely play a factor. You know, not everyone has the skeleton of Michael Phelps. There are things like that that no amount of willpower and determination and grit can cultivate. But in just about every field, though, grit does seem to outweigh genetics by quite a lot.
Well, I'd like to get into some of the specifics about how to cultivate this in our lives, but here's another bigger question. Is it possible that grit is actually something that is innate? It seems like there are people who they just have it in them, even from a young age, to have this kind of determined attitude toward and proclivity and desire for success, that the kid next to him is just kind of content to look at the ceiling and not really apply himself like that. It seems like there is some kind of innate something beyond, say, some of those intelligence factors and other things that really make a difference with someone's success.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think that most of us would look at a person's grittiness and kind of see it the way we would view their height or their eye color, as kind of fixed and unchangeable. What you're born with is what you have. But according to this, you know, this research, that's not the case. I'll read a quick quote here from the book. It says, when you actually get to the specifics, what specifically are gritty people like? What do they do when they wake up in the morning? What beliefs do they walk around with in their heads? When you get to that level of specifics, you realize there's no reason why these things can't be taught, practiced, and learned.
So there may be some innate measurable quantity of this within one person over another person, but essentially the message here is, just because you lack it doesn't mean you can't have it.
That's right. Yeah, the main message of the book really is that you can grow grit from the inside out. And through decades of extensively studying and interviewing soldiers, athletes, musicians, business people, students, and all kinds of other people, Duckworth has identified four main qualities that gritty people develop in abundance. And really, I think if we just break those down, then you can see how you can actually grow more grit in your life.
Okay. Four main qualities. Let's talk about the first one.
Okay. Yep. Number one is interest. And interest has to be the kind that rests on something. If it flits about from one thing to another, if you're kind of the type of person who stays interested in something for a couple of months or a year, but then says, you know what, I'd like to see about this other realm of knowledge over here, then you're probably not going to develop the kind of grit that later translates into excellence and success. So it has to have some staying power.
So is this the type of thing that you got to be careful about what you commit yourself to, because you want it to be good so that you're going to stick with it? Because it seems like there's always something that is capturing your interest that you could say, you know, well, I really want to do this. I've got to, you know, do it at the expense of something else in my life. How do you stick with the thing that you've decided to do?
Well, it sounds like what you have to do is early in life, hopefully, do a lot of kind of trial and error. Try a lot of things, fail at a lot of things, fail fast so that you know what to move on to. And that way, once you have explored a bit and you've failed at a certain number of things and you've tried them on and said, these pants don't fit, then you can find a pair that does fit and that you're willing to maintain interest in for long enough to really, go on to the next steps.
Yeah. So if you're interested in something, it seems like that tends to fuel the kind of stick-to-itiveness that you really need. What's the next step that you need to, in order to really develop grit? What do you have to develop?
Step number two is practice. And it can't be just any kind of practice. It has to be the type that translates into continuous improvement. So basically that means deliberate practice. And deliberate practice is not enjoyable most of the time. So you have to have that interest in step number one established well enough to be very passionate, so passionate, in fact, that you're willing to endure pretty tedious, unpleasant, in a way, deliberate practice. So here's how it's explained in the book, this type of practice. You're concentrating 100% and you've deliberately set the level of challenge to exceed your current level of skill. You're in problem-solving mode, analyzing everything you do to bring it closer to the ideal, the goal that you set at the beginning of the practice session. So it's significantly more effortful and less enjoyable than other types of practice, but it is the type that that will make a person continuously improve and avoid that plateau of stagnation.
So I imagine that you've got a pretty good chunk of people who would say, yeah, I want more grit. And then when you get down to it, you say, well, that means that you have to stick with something for a long time, that you have to work really hard at it and be very deliberate in your practicing, that you've lost a lot of people at that point. Well, you know, maybe grit isn't something that I need so much because I just don't want to have to work that hard.
That's right. It's not a quick magic cure for everything. All you need is a little bit of grit. In order to acquire grit, it is, it's a lifelong pursuit of excellence, which basically means lots and lots of rigorous effort. So if you're looking for a quick fix, grit's not it.
Yeah. So the third step.
Third step is a polished purpose. And basically in this context, purpose means giving to others. It means that you have to sort of have a view of whatever your pursuit is that transcends yourself. It has to be something that you come to feel benefits other people, whether it's kind of in a very specific way. You know, this is good for my clients. This is good for my children. It's good for my students. Or it could even be in an abstract way. This pursuit is good for this country. It's good for this sport. It's good for science or society. But one way or the other, though, you have to have a purpose that expands beyond yourself.
That's really interesting because it seems like the message that people hear so much of the time is that you've got to do it for you.
Right. Yeah, this totally contradicts that. And in fact, most of this research says if that is your view, you're very likely to fizzle out. You'll just grow tired if it's a totally self-serving pursuit. There's one quote here that says, at its core, purpose is the idea that what we do matters to people other than ourselves. It is the intention to contribute to the well-being of others.
So they're finding this just based on interviews and assessments of a lot of successful people who tend to have this quality, and they're recognizing that this is something that applies across the board. Yet this is something that anyone familiar with the theology of the Bible would see. You know, it aligns perfectly with statements like it's more blessed to give than to receive, and it is a very outward-focused a deeds-oriented kind of a way of life. This really seems to back up, say, what people who followed the advice of the Bible had been doing for millennia.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is, if you've read the Bible, you will know that it's more blessed to give to receive. But also, if you've lived through a few decades of life, especially three or four or five, you just come to realize that sometimes by some sort of painful trial and error. If you're totally living for yourself and for your own interests, it's just not going to be a life that feels fulfilling, and it won't be a life that's fulfilling enough to make you continue day in and day out with the kind of interest and deliberate practice and things like that that we're talking about.
The fourth and final ingredient that this author has identified that helps us to build grit.
The final component is hope, even when all seems lost. So this is basically, it's the kind of hope that when you suffer a terrible defeat in whatever your pursuit is, you have this hope that says, despite this defeat, I'm going to try again. And so it's not the kind of hope that places the onus on the universe to sort of sand the rough circumstances into something smooth. Instead, this is the kind of hope that really rests on the expectation that our own efforts can improve our future, despite whatever short-term or even, you know, long-term setbacks we've suffered.
You know, it's interesting hearing these points, just thinking about one of the booklets that we offer. It's one of the most successful booklets that we have, The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong, how much overlap there is between what she's describing as a really probably the most important element of success and the points that Mr. Armstrong brings out at that booklet. In that booklet, he talks so much about drive and the importance of really driving and persevering and resourcefulness and getting around obstacles and then sticking with a thing, even when there are setbacks which are bound to happen along the course of that road. It seems like really these are very compatible messages.
You're exactly right. As I read through this book about grit, I had a copy of The 7 Laws of Success right there beside me, and so many of these laws overlapped. Really, where this book about grit ends and does not overlap with Mr. Armstrong's book about success is setting the right goal. Mm. You know, that's and getting help from God to accomplish the goal. So it's very much about the nuts and bolts, the practicality of how to be a good Olympian or employee or something like that. But if you read this alongside The 7 Laws of Success, you can learn how to really have grit in the pursuits that matter, which are the ones that Mr. Armstrong was writing about: becoming the best parent you can be, the best spouse you can be, the best Christian you can be, things like that. So it's to me, the two really are wonderful companion books.
So just out of curiosity to finish, has reading this book and becoming more familiar with this strategy that you're talking about here, has it changed your approach to any of your pursuits?
I think it has. I think, I've always known that there's great power in effort, and that what you might lack in natural ability or genetic predisposition, you can largely compensate for with just a lot more perseverance and whatnot. But this book, I think, because it breaks it down into those components of interest, practice, purpose, and hope, I think that it has helped me in some ways, and hopefully it'll do so even more going forward.
All right. Well, we appreciate that. It is refreshing to hear that kind of instruction and information in a world that just kind of puts the focus on the innate ability and the talent and the physique and so on. But really, what's in the heart tends to make the biggest difference in determining your success or failure in life. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He's working on an article about this subject, grit. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Jeremiah.
Pleasure to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
The Philadelphia Church of God uses the marriage ceremony that Herbert W. Armstrong composed. It's a beautiful service. And at the end of that ceremony, the minister asks, "Do you, groom, faithfully promise and covenant with God in the presence of these witnesses to take this bride, her name, to be your lawfully wedded wife, to love her, cherish her, honor her, and provide for her?" The man responds, "I do." And he makes a covenant, not with his wife, but with God. What is a covenant? Well, it's an agreement. In that ceremony, the man agrees to love, cherish, honor, and provide for the wife God has blessed him with. And in return, God binds that marriage. The point is, marriage and family are covenant relationships. It's not just casual associations. They're binding contractual relationships that come with conditions and terms and obligations and responsibilities for each member. Consider briefly just one of the responsibilities associated with the marriage relationship, as reflected in the marriage ceremony that Mr. Armstrong wrote. A man must provide for his family. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8 says, "If any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." If a man doesn't provide, his religion is worthless. In fact, God says he's worse than an unbeliever. This is specifically talking about material provision, but in principle, it includes providing spiritually, emotionally, and so on. So that shows a father is in a covenant relationship that makes him duty-bound to put the needs of his family ahead of his own desires. The blessings of family life come with a set of specific God-ordained obligations that he must fulfill if he's to remain in good standing with God. This is just one of those obligations. The Bible has several others that it lists. And of course, the same is true of the wife and even of the children. The blessings of being a part of that family come with specific responsibilities and obligations to that family. In fact, you could argue that each family member fulfilling those obligations is what distinguishes and even defines that family relationship. The covenant roles set family relationships apart from relationships of any other group of people who may happen to live together. Family isn't just people and love, as many tend to view it. It's actually a God-inspired governmental structure where each member fulfills a specific role to contribute to the working of the group. In 1 Corinthians 7 and verses 32 to 33, Paul talks about how a married man must take care to please his wife. This is how the Living Bible puts it. He has to think about his earthly responsibilities. The Moffat translation says, "The unmarried man is anxious about the Lord's affairs, how best to satisfy the Lord. The married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how best to satisfy his wife." So he is torn in two directions. Now, any married man who's trying to fulfill his responsibilities to his family can identify with that. The same goes for women. It talks about that in the same passage. Taking care of a husband is a big job. And Paul, he hasn't even broached the subject of when children enter the picture. Married life consumes a lot of attention and energy and focus. Now, many consider that a negative thing, but in God's view, it can be extremely positive. A person can learn invaluable lessons by dedicating his or her attention and energy toward family. In fact, family is a wonderful tool to help us conquer our natural carnal selfishness. Marriage and family teach us how to give consistently and unconditionally, to give even when you don't feel like you have anything to give, and to love even when you feel like, well, the other person doesn't really deserve your love. The fact that it is a covenant relationship keeps us dedicated to it, even when selfishly we may have other ideas. We commit to family, and then once we're in it, we're bound to remain in it. And that commitment enables us to grow through difficulties and challenges and continue to chip away at our selfish tendencies. It's not natural, but it's a great training ground for developing God's character and learning how to employ God's love. Proper family life is selfless. Embrace the family life. Use that powerful tool God has given us to conquer our selfishness. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Anthony Chibodwe, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from George Washington. Perseverance and spirit have done wonders in all ages. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.